Well, while this is loading, I want to thank you for coming. It's nice to see you here, and presumably everybody has an interest in and or experience with immigrants into the country. We can hardly avoid running into immigrants in our practice or our students if we're teachers, et cetera. So let's see. There we go. Well, what's in a word? From our childhood, we remember that old phrase, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me." And we know that names do hurt people. Language can hurt people as well as build them up. The goal of health equity, embodied in this year's annual meeting, Public Health Without Borders, mandates a commitment to justice and a systematic assessment of health determinants. Racism, poverty, environmental exposures, wealth disparities, and social class play integral roles in influencing health equity. And these elements come alive through the language and images used to portray immigrants living and working without juridical status in the United States. And as you notice with this slide, there are images of two different borders, our southern border with Mexico and the northern border with Canada. And when we talk about immigration in the country, it feels like we're always talking about the southern border, and we never talk about the northern border with Canada, because we flow much more freely as white people, mostly, going back and forth between these two countries. And economically, they're fairly equivalent. Whereas with the southern border, with Mexico, we know that economically, we're not equivalent, we're asymmetrical, and that people coming through the southern borders are largely people of color. Well, immigration is a hot topic in the US. When we speak about immigrants, it is usually about unauthorized immigrants. Unauthorized immigrants come to the US looking for a better life most of the time. These immigrants usually are running away from poverty, oppression, and unemployment that is widespread in their own countries. We meet them ourselves in a variety of clinical settings, and we might or might not know who they are. And could I just ask for a show of hands, anyone who's met an immigrant and knows who they are? I'm sure that most of us can say that. Okay. Understanding the power of language as a destructive or constructive tool is critical to knowing how to resist dehumanizing images and deploying language that connects humans in relationships that promote health. How we talk about undocumented immigrants is crucial for supporting their efforts for health and dignity, for promoting all-inclusive public health measures, and for positively influencing immigration policy related to immigrant health care. Words create impressions, images, and expectations. They build psychological connections. They do influence how we think. And since thoughts determine actions, there's a powerful connection between words we use and the results we get. Demeaning words can kill enthusiasm, self-esteem, lower expectations, and hold people back. And well-chosen words can motivate, offer hope, create vision, influence our thinking positively, and alter results. In this collective presentation, negative rhetoric and hate speech promulgated in the media about undocumented immigrants will be analyzed for undertones of racism, violence, and exclusion that are inimical to the health of undocumented immigrants. And alternative nonviolent language about undocumented immigrants will be proposed for public health nurses to deploy in their practices, educate the public, and influence humane immigration policy development. So we want to see through the hype, which we already do probably. I have a sense that I'm already preaching to the choir, but we can use Lillian Wald and her early example as a way to turn around the negativity. This can be done in ways that Denise will address later, but basically we want to portray immigrants largely in a positive light and humanize our social talk about immigrants and our images. we want to influence the social environment towards health enhancing environments. Also, nursing education needs to incorporate media literacy, as if we need another thing, but we do need media literacy into nursing education, and use an integrative approach while teaching leadership and ethics to create awareness of the influence of media. And at the graduate level, perhaps a deeper integration or a course on health, health systems, and media representations. Media analysis might also be incorporated into the underpinnings of health disparities when we're considering research or talking about health disparities and looking at the social determinants of health. As nurses develop media savviness, they are more empowered to engage in media representation of the most vulnerable among us, especially less privileged immigrants. Thinking about language used helps us, or numerous media outlets are available to change the vitriolic language to nonviolent, life-enhancing language. And these include, besides television, where we're beginning to see nurses as spokespersons, newspaper articles, editorials written by nurses, radio interviews, and also, of course, the worldwide media, the web. We're looking at blogs, web pages, and websites. And moving up from that onto media advocacy. Thinking about language also helps us to identify its political underpinnings. Racist language might be masked or overt, as shown in one of the web links later. It can be rephrased as one of equality. If the language incites to violence, it is dangerous to the life and health of some of the immigrants, as will be demonstrated later. If the language sets up a divide between them and us, it is divisive. Does the language ever refer to ourselves as immigrants or as descendants of immigrants? So these are questions that everyone can ask themselves in terms of what we hear on the airways and the media and immigrants, the vitriol against immigrants. What we need in media is common sense, dialogue, discussion, and problem-solving approaches in which the dynamics of migration are better understood, policies are understood, and there is a win-win situation for everyone. We need to promote images that help the country or everyone recognize the contributions of immigrants, and that those contributions are documented by organizations that have done the research. As I said earlier, we're building on our legacy, and we're not doing anything new, but we're remembering our roots, and I bring to all of our attention that Lillian Wald and the Nurses of Henry Street were reframing negative imagery into positive imagery a century before George Lakoff came along with his book on reframing. Maybe he read Lillian Wald. On reflection on what we hear in the media and the faces we see, we cannot help but ask, what is the point? What is the purpose of all this negativity and hate speech? Why does it seem to be escalating? Who has power and how much power? What we are about to view and hear more resembles histrionics than careful journalism, and we know that histrionics can whip up fervors in ordinarily decent people. And if I get access to the internet, I can bring up I right-click. Well, I guess it's not going to work. What I wanted to do was show a little video clip, but this presentation is being recorded, and probably these slides are downloadable. And you'll be able to right-click on the links and bring up these websites and look at the films on YouTube, you know, short little films that are 1 to 3 minutes, etc. And they do show people like Lou Dobbs and Bill Riley and some of these more, I would call them histrionic types of media representations of immigrants. Okay. There are code words of hate, and here's another link that you can bring up and show. It shows a woman talking about the schools, and the schools are going down because all these immigrant kids are coming into them, and we're spending our money on these immigrant children without, of course, recognizing the fact that immigrants too pay taxes. To get back to a little bit of history, the whole anti-immigrant hate speech campaigns began with John Tatton of Petoskey, Michigan. He's a retired ophthalmologist, and he founded numerous anti-immigrant groups. And I'm going to show you a conceptual map that shows the links between these newer immigrant groups that are continually forming and dissolving and forming and dissolving, et cetera, and think tanks that develop the anti-immigrant language that disseminate into the media, et cetera. And what the map shows, I believe, is that this is simply not a random phenomenon, but that it's very deliberate, that these groups are connected, that the politics is organized and it's intentional. And this map is taken from the Nockel Report, an issue that came out in 2007 from an article, The Anti-Immigration Movement, From Shovels to Suits. The Nockel Report is a report that comes out bimonthly and writes articles, usually investigative journalism articles and some opinion articles that are documented on what is going on in Latin America and various issues and various phenomena in various countries of Latin America. So as you see over on the left-hand side, we have some rather conservative immigrant groups that are not necessarily hate groups, but over on the right-hand side, we see the vigilantes, we see attacks on day laborers, we see overt and covert racism, we see the white supremacist movement and neo-Nazi groups, et cetera. And we also, if you look at that map really closely, you'll see some of the funding agencies and the think tanks. So they're all pretty connected. All right, I want to go back a little bit into history and show how certain groups were targeted for negative rhetoric and that the targeting of the rhetoric justified the policies that were developed against them all the way from simply discrimination and exclusion all the way up to extermination and genocide. And I think history teaches us a lot about the metaphors that have been used. Jewish people were labeled primarily as parasites who were bleeding the nation of its life sustenance, as if they were not contributing anything. The constant reference to the Jews and other undesirables, such as the mentally ill and infirm elders, as parasites became fixed through propaganda promulgated through word of mouth, film, which was used as an escape mechanism during wartime, and public speeches as they paved the way for deportation and genocide in the infamous concentration camps. The fascinating work of Susan Benedict from the Medical College of South Carolina and colleagues sheds light on the various nursing responses all the way from collusion to resistance. And she's using primary historical documents to do that work. The Irish experience. Well, growing up, I always wondered if potatoes were the only crop grown in Ireland. I never asked anybody the question, but in my mind, it's like, is that all they have is potatoes growing over there? Anyway, colonization had much to do with the way the Irish were portrayed during the Great Hunger. How this picture justified the poor response of the British government to starvation and the lack of a vigorous policy of ensuring the Irish didn't starve. Instead, the hunger was used as an excuse to exterminate the Irish people. And I don't know if you know how many millions of, several million Irish died both in Ireland of the starvation and on what we call the coffin ships that came over and they were diseased. Of course, their immunity wore down, they got really diseased, they got, and they died of certainly totally preventative types of problems. So a biometeorological phenomenon became a socio-political phenomenon. And this is one of the images of the Great Hunger. I think this is a fairly common image that you'll see if you look at Irish history and Irish literature. The Irish, or Ireland as a country, never received an apology from England until Prime Minister Tony Blair finally issued an apology when he was in office. So it took more than a century. And there's still memory in Ireland of this starvation. And in our own country, we saw Southern and Eastern European immigrants looked upon as a lesser form of humanity. These were people coming from Italy and from other parts of Europe, non-traditional parts of Europe. And this kind of denigration of these folks really led to the first immigration law in 1924, which imposed quota systems on immigrants. They were portrayed, obviously, as being inferior intellectually, as bringing diseases over to the country, as criminals, and as less than human. The consequences of the negative rhetoric that we hear today are marginalization, undocumented immigrants having to live underground, being hypervigilant and always watching over their shoulder for the border patrols or the ICE raids that are occurring right now, and hypervigilance, which leads itself to stress and the problems, health problems that are related to stress. Their human rights are constantly under threat. The ICE doesn't have enough to do with Homeland Security, so now all of these hundreds and thousands of agents are being sent out to find undocumented immigrants. All right, and healthcare, as many of us know, is difficult to secure because of fear of going to a healthcare provider or other reasons. Therefore, health interventions are delayed, et cetera. So just a few alternative metaphors, and Denise will go into this in more length. Instead of illegal, we could say undocumented or unauthorized, which is a respectful way to refer to undocumented immigrants. Instead of hordes, we can say diverse individuals, because there is diversity in immigrants who come to the country. Instead of lawbreakers or criminals, the vast majority are law-abiding. They're terrified of breaking a law because they don't want to get deported, and they're respectful of the law. And instead of disease-ridden, they are healthy, or we can talk about health disparities, or we can talk about global health disparities. So they're just ways that we can counteract the negative metaphors. I just wanted to touch very briefly on global migration, because this is not only a problem in our country, but it's a problem worldwide, and it's particularly a problem in terms of anti-immigrant movements in the European Union and other wealthier countries against immigrants coming from poor countries. Okay. So here are some of the migration routes. There is also a globalized advocacy for immigrants and undocumented immigrants, and this is an image of protesters of deportations in the European Union. This is one in San Francisco, I believe, where a group of people kept vigil for a group of immigrants that were being detained. And to summarize, we could ask ourselves, what is justice for immigrants? We can analyze the language and the methodology describing immigrants. We can develop alternatives. We can deploy alternatives. We can advocate in the media, and we can influence policy on immigration issues. Is there a human right to migrate? There's a film out. I haven't seen it yet myself, from activist video, Beyond Borders. It's supposed to be a real balanced look at the whole immigration phenomenon. And of course, we might look at our own ancestry, because all of us came from somewhere. It's a good thing to do with students if they can get access to that information. These are the recent immigrants that we're seeing, and as we know that they're doing some of the hardest work in the country, and work that doesn't pay very well, and they're often living in substandard conditions that are not good for their health. They work in our factories, they work in the garment industry, they work in agriculture, construction, restaurants, fast food places, etc. And with that, here are some resources. They'll be on the slides for you. The Southern Poverty Law Center has a number of articles that can be used to look at what is going on with the anti-immigration movement in the language. And some other websites are Media Matters and the Anti-Defamation League. Center for New Community is based in Chicago. And Center for American Progress And then fairness and accuracy in reporting, which has been around for a while and looks at a whole variety of issues.